I am completely operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly.
And that is exactly how I feel today. Boy, am I rested and refreshed. Back from vacation here. Greg Kokel, live with you and lively on Stand to Reason. Yeah, it's amazing what 2.5 weeks in Wisconsin, well, 2 weeks in Wisconsin in my case, will do for you. Out at the cabin, in the boat, landing the fish. It's been great to be away, ladies and gentlemen, but it is equally fine to be back. I am refreshed and motivated and ready to take on the world, and thank you for allowing me that time away the last couple weeks from the radio show. Again, thanks to Brett Kunkel, who filled in for me while I was gone. I hope you enjoyed him. You'll be hearing more from him as time goes on, because we appreciate the work he's doing for us and for me when I'm on vacation. But, yeah, I took my annual junket back to Wisconsin. As many of you know, especially if you've been following this program for a while, years, I grew up in Chicago, and in 1960, my grandpa built a cabin or bought some property, which we as kids and my dad and others helped him build in the early 60s. And, of course, the summers we spent up there at least a portion of time. And actually, a couple of summers I spent up most of that time. And when I came out to the West Coast in 1972, spent about, it was about an 18-year hiatus after I came to know the Lord, and I was kind of stuck out here next to the Pacific Ocean and in the Sierras. And you look at the Sierras are beautiful, and the ocean is great. But I got to tell you, my heart is in the North Woods. So when in the late 80s I started going back to northern Wisconsin, to our cabin up there in the Minocqua Woodruff area, Lac du Flambeau, the land of the lakes. Of course, that's the phrase for Minnesota, but this really works for northern Wisconsin as well. Well, it just was really great to refresh and renew that that relationship with that property. My grandpa's gone. My mom summers there now, and as best as she's able. And my wife and I, and now my little girl, Annabeth, we all head up there late May, early June, for a couple of 2 or 3 weeks of relaxation and fishing. And as it turned out, this time there was no great stories to tell. I usually have some kind of radical adventure. The fact is, most of us were sick for a portion of the time. The baby when we left, my wife when we got there, me a week and a half later, which was a problem because I always teach up at a local church up there in Woodruff every summer for the last 10 or so years. And there was a big special event on the Da Vinci Code that was a community outreach scheduled for Sunday night last. And for the first week and a half, I'm out there yelling at the fish and whatever, you know, fine, I got a good voice. But then my caught with my wife had, and on Friday night last, a week ago Friday, my voice was gone. I had laryngitis. Saturday, I couldn't talk. I'm supposed to do 4 different talks on Sunday, 2 in the service, 1 in the afternoon, 2 a camp, and then in the evening, the big event that they've been publicizing for about 2 months on the Da Vinci Code all throughout the community. And I lost my voice, so I had to go to the emergency room, just like my wife did the week before, to get meds, and they pumped me up with some steroids, and that's why my voice is so nice and low. And my muscles are big, and I've been knocking home runs out of the park. And I was able to do the events on Sunday, and it worked out really well. On the way, I want to talk to you a little bit here in reflection about some conversations I've had in the last couple of days. And you don't know how many times I wish that all of you were kind of just listening over my shoulder in a certain fashion at some of the encounters that I have with people. As a training exercise, as a way of seeing how I work through the task of being an ambassador for Christ. And I don't mean task in the sense that it's a burden, but I think it is a task in the sense that it's a skill. It's something we want to put our minds to and we want to work at, so that we are more effective at that. And there are guidelines that you can follow. The last 3 days I spent up in San Jose at a stock investors conference. It's one of those conferences where you pay money to learn how to trade successfully, specifically in the area of options. That's what I'm interested in, and I've been doing this for a while. But these kinds of conferences, though, focus in on the idea that if you want to survive out there in the market, you have to know the rules. You have to know how the game is played, as it were, how the markets work, and you have to be very careful about how you manage your risk and place your trades and manage the trade as it goes on and hedge and all these other things. And I'm not going to go into the details there. I'm just making the point that the emphasis there is that if you want to be successful, there are lots of ways to get killed in the market. And so you want to be careful that you watch for particulars. And there's a sense in which there's a parallel here with being a Christian ambassador. And I'm not saying that God can't rescue you from a lot of your mistakes or my mistakes, and he does frequently, that's great, but we don't want to put him to the test. In other words, we don't want to throw ourselves into a situation foolishly in which he's got to rescue us for something good to happen. Just like if we're smart, we wouldn't throw money into a trade we haven't considered from different angles and then pray that God rescues us from a bad decision. We don't want to do the same thing in our diplomacy with others as we represent Christ to them. And so a lot of what Stand to Reason is doing is helping you to hedge, helping you to assess in advance and look at the mistakes that others make and mistakes that could be changed. And so you want to make sure you don't do these things, and you do these things that will ensure more success, that will keep you from faltering, that might be make you more effective. And so there are things that we have in place, as it were, that are guidelines, and we try to make this as useful or as accessible as possible. We try to throw the ball so that you can catch it. Instead of giving talks or writing pieces, letters, newsletters, whatever, to you that's filled with a bunch of exciting talk about God and ideas, we want to give you some checkpoints of sorts. We want to take those ideas and reduce them to steps and something that you can remember. For example, I tell people that I have a modest goal when I go into conversations, and that is to put a stone in someone's shoe. I don't try to win them to Christ right then. I don't try to hit a home run or a grand slam. You know, I don't even try to get on base. I just try to get up to bat. And if you can try to just get up to bat, you may get on base. If you think you have to hit a home run or a grand slam, you're not going to get up to bat, then you're never going to get anywhere. But if you think, gee, if I can just swing at a few, then maybe I'll connect. And so we lower the expectation to get you in the game, as it were, and that makes you more productive over the long run. Okay, makes sense? Well, I was party to a couple of conversations, I think, that served to articulate this point. Oh, by the way, I didn't give the phone number, did I? We are taking calls today, and there's one holding right now from Charlotte, North Carolina. We'll get to in a few moments. 1-800-227-5278 is my number, coast to coast, in the 714 area code. That's local to where I'm at right now at KBRT Studios. 754-4150 here, so that's Orange County roughly. 754-4150, you can get into that line. So get in the queue, and I'll be glad to talk to you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. But when we were coming back from our trip, my wife and I were sitting together with our lap baby. This is the first time we actually have to put her in our lap. But it was kind of nice for the whole trip, 3.5 hours. Our little girl is laying across our lap, and the guy to my right was absolutely, you know, three across, baby and across our laps. And the guy to the right, I was sitting in the middle. He was absolutely enthralled with little Annabeth, which was nice. And we look for opportunity to build conversations there. As a good ambassador, always looking for openings. But I didn't see an opening with him. But behind me, there was a gentleman sitting right in the middle who was a Christian who was talking about his faith quite aggressively. Now, as I listened, and it was hard to miss because he was talking so loudly, he was witnessing first to the guy in the aisle on his right and then to the person about a half hour later on his left. Very aggressively talking about Jesus and talking about fulfilled prophecy and opening his Bible, which apparently he had been reading there, and offering a kind of a Hal Lindsey characterization of end times events, and that there'll be 200 million man army coming from Red China that crosses the Euphrates River and attacks Israel, and Gog and Magog is Russia, and they're going to attack from the north, and then God's going to decimate those armies, and so he's going through the entire thing, kind of a pre-tribulation, pre-millennial old dispensational approach to eschatology, basically a left-behind kind of approach, which I think is a credible view. I don't know that all aspects of it are correct, but this is what he's offering in defense of the gospel that he's offering, which he offered very clearly, and I appreciated that he offered it from the perspective of the law. And with one guy's running through the Ten Commandments, have you kept this? Have you done this? Have you ever told a lie? Have you ever cheated? Have you ever put God first place in everything? In fact, there are sometimes he actually even sounded like Stand to Reason guy in the way that he's doing the bad news first and the particular way he did it. I'm sure that my suspicion is he's had some exposure to Hell's Best Kept Secret and the folks that kind of promote that, the master's way and that kind of thing. And so I was really Kirk Cameron and the rest of the crowd there. So it was good that he's doing this, but he was really being loud. In fact, the people in front of me were turning around and kind of looking over like, who is that guy? And not only did he talk about eschatology and end times and the gospel and the law, but he started getting into creationism and was handing out Ken Ham books and talked about a 6,000-year-old earth and was giving away books. And then he was giving away New Testaments and the Gospel of John to the guys he was talking to. And through the course of the flight, he witnessed thoroughly to the person on his right. And when he was done there, he's reading his Bible for a little while. Then he began discussing things with the person on his left and witnessed thoroughly with him. In other words, went through all the same things that he had said to the person on the right, to the person on the left. Now, let me give you an idea of some of the things that I was thinking about while this is going on. First, I was glad he was sharing his faith. God bless this man. I know his first name. I don't want to say it because it might give something away. I don't know. Somebody might be listening who knows. But because I have a criticism. But I want you to know that I'm glad he's out there in the marketplace with the gospel of Jesus Christ, talking with everyone he can about it. In fact, he was on his way to Australia, and I think that what he does is he works for 5 months and then takes a month off, and then he works for 5 months and he takes a month off. And for that month, he goes somewhere out of the country, and he does some kind of mission work. And this is a guy who's deeply committed to Christ and is not afraid to share his faith, and I bet you he wins a lot of people to Christ. And so I am thankful for what he did. He also did some things that I think we can learn from, but there were a couple of other things I was concerned about. He was willing to take the step, willing to engage people. He was giving a book or a New Testament or a Gospel of John. He was leaving that behind, and that was a good thing. In fact, I was encouraged by that because I should be doing that more often, frankly. I should be keeping more Gospels of John's with me. If you're going to leave something behind, it's best to leave a readable version of Scripture there. I argued in the past in a piece that I wrote for our Solid Ground, and I talked about it here on the radio. Actually, it was our ministry letter. But if you receive our monthly mailings, our free mailings, then you would have received this, an argument about why I think that the New Testament is inspired and how to persuade other people. And though we've approached this in different ways, what I said, the main thing to do is just get them to read the Gospels. Don't argue that the gospel is inspired. Just let him read Jesus. Let Jesus do the work, so to speak. Let him do the heavy lifting. And so I suggested, so I was encouraged more. Now, maybe I should carry more Gospels of John with me, and then when I get in these conversations, I can leave it behind. And I could say, you know what? Don't read Ken Ham. Don't read Hal Lindsey. Don't read Greg Kochel. I don't have anything against any of those guys, including myself. But the point is, let's just read Jesus. He's not that hard, especially the Gospel of John is high Christology, and I think it's a good place to start. So I was glad that he did that. I was glad that he was engaging. I was glad that he's using evidences. A couple of missteps, though. One is he's talking really loud. That is, it wasn't just the people next to him that were engaged in the conversation, but I'd say about 10 or 15 other people. Now, of course, you might think that's an advantage, because then a lot of people are hearing the gospel, but they weren't willing listeners, were they? This was a conversation that was loud enough to intrude in their privacy. They're trying to do other things. And so my suspicion is, on balance, this is the kind of thing that's going to annoy more people than help more people. And so it might have been better if he kept his conversation as much as possible between he and the person he was talking with. Also, when he moved to the person on the other side of him, that person had already heard through kind of ricochet evangelism the whole presentation. Then they got it a second time when he was talking directly with them. Another thing, too, though, is that he presented a lot of information. Eschatology, Jesus' return, the rebirth of the nation of Israel, Russia, Gog and Magog, China, 200 million man army. And by the way, he represented this as if the Bible taught this. Now, this is a credible interpretation of biblical prophecy, but the Bible doesn't say those things. And then he got off into creationism and Ken Ham, and I'm not complaining about Ken Ham, but why? And the 6,000-year-old earth. Now, there are different opinions about this, but why does somebody have to jump through that hurdle before he engages the gospel of Jesus Christ? Do you see how, as I've said in the past, the gospel is offensive enough or difficult enough or hard enough or big enough to deal with all at once without having to deal with a whole bunch of other controversial issues? Sure. So maybe it would have been better if he didn't do all those other things. You know, there are people that would be willing to listen to the case for Jesus Christ who would not even countenance the idea of a 6,000-year-old earth. Even if the idea of a 6,000-year-old earth is true, why put that obstacle in their way? It's hard enough just dealing with Jesus. Leave that out. Don't make them jump through that hoop. After they become a follower of Christ and they have the spiritual insight and maturity to engage some of these more complicated issues, then let them confront that, but not first out. The other thing is that there was just a tremendous amount of religious language that was kind of in there and aggressiveness. And as my wife and I were whispering a little bit and talking a little bit in reflection about this, very much to ourselves so others could hear, we thought that he could have been a little more gentle in his approach, a little bit more ambassadorial. Now, you got to know, I'm glad he was doing what he was doing. And my wife and I were each individually praying for him while he was talking, that God would use the words that he was saying. So this is a kind of a, not a complaint or an objection, but it's a kind of a, in a sense, calling Apollos aside and, you know, teaching him a little bit more accurately. This is where this effort could have been trimmed up a little bit, and maybe you can learn from the process too. Now, from that, I have a couple of points I'm going to share with you right after we take our break, and then I'm going to jump into the calls. A couple of quick points that you might want to get a piece of paper and write down, and I suspect I'm going to put this in a ministry letter coming up shortly, so you'll also get it in print if you receive our free mailings. If you don't, go to our website at str.org and register and then sign up for Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter, and the ministry letter that comes on the alternate months. And then you'll eventually get this because I think this is going to be useful. But what I want to do is I want to just go back. Now, having talked about that in general, so you can think, okay, I got some general ideas about what I should and shouldn't do as a good ambassador for Jesus Christ, a good representative of him in the marketplace, I'm going to try to then put it in some strike points for you so you can remember them very clearly. Here's some guideline points, and there are 8 of them. So when we come back, I'll quickly go through them, then we'll go to your calls. 1-800-227-5278. Those lines are full right now, but in the 714 area code, 754-4150, lots of room there. Of course, as I move through the calls, more lines will be available. I'm Greg Kokel, live here on Stand to Reason. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, well, I've got great news for you. After more than a year in development, the brand new Stand to Reason interactive training series on tactics in defending the faith is now available on DVD. Included are 6 one-hour sessions where I train you step-by-step in valuable, easy-to-use, time-tested techniques that keep you in the driver's seat when talking with others. It's perfect for home groups, for Sunday school, for Bible studies, for homeschooling, with interactive discussion questions, role-playing, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, and a leader guide and a 100-page comprehensive workbook that you can reproduce for each member of your group. Now, if you learn best by listening, mentoring CDs are available, but the best combination is to get them both. Then you'll have the DVD training course, the mentoring CDs to listen to in the car or on your iPod, and the comprehensive 100-page workbook. Now, the special pre-order price through the end of the month is $39.95. After that, it'll be $50, so order now. The Tactics DVDs will ship by the end of the month. Go to our website at str.org or call us at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Don't delay. str.org or 1-800-2-REASON.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Put another candle on my birthday cake. We're gonna bake a birthday cake. Put another candle on my birthday cake. I'm another year old today. I'm gonna have a party with my birthday cake.
Okay.
Come on and take.
Thank you very much. I have to put up with that song only once a year, fortunately. And I'm another year older yesterday, actually. 56 now and counting. And I still have my girlish figure, but I am feeling older than I was 10 years ago. Who isn't, actually, anymore? Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and I started out talking about a conversation that I heard in the airplane coming back from my vacation in Wisconsin of a gentleman, a Christian, God bless his heart, vigorously sharing his faith and evangelizing behind the seat behind me, directly behind me, and been talking about what some of the things we can learn, both good and bad, from what I observed there, and take his effort, which was a good one, and kind of channel it in a little bit more constructive direction. And so I am going to just give you eight application, little points of application, and I want you to write these down because I think they will help you. The first one is look for opportunities. This man was an ambassador for Christ. He was clearly there looking for opportunities to share his faith. He had a captive audience for 3.5 hours, one person on either side of him. One wonders if he chose the middle seat on purpose just so he'd have two people to talk to instead of just one. But I wouldn't be surprised with this person because obviously he took evangelism very seriously. And so he was watching, and a good ambassador, and this is part of our ambassador's creed, I think the very first item, that we are looking for opportunities. We always are alert for what might turn out to be a divine appointment. So that's the first one. Second one, even so, when you find your opportunity, don't give people too much information. Don't try to give them like theology 101, eschatology 101, creationism 101. Now, it might turn out that that's the thing that's at issue that brings you into the conversation. Somebody's talking about evolution, and even if you're a young earther, I would say don't make that the issue there. Rather attack evolution and offer some broader sense of intelligent design, because that's what's really important for getting the gospel to this person at the time. But that's a judgment call for yourself. If it doesn't come up, then don't bring it up. The gospel's hard enough as it is. Don't overcomplicate things by bringing in way too many things for them to consider. All right? Just try to put a stone in their shoe. So that's the second point. The first one, look for opportunities. Secondly, when you get an opportunity, don't overcomplicate things. Keep it simple. Don't give them too many hoops to jump through. Three, try to stay away from religious language and terminology and religious affect. This person was very religious in his whole approach. And I think this is hard for us as Christians because we are brought up in a Christian environment and it's natural for us to talk this way, but it sounds weird. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people who may be in principle interested in a bona fide, genuine relationship with God through Jesus Christ who are not interested in Christian religion. And this is where I think a lot of the emergent guys that are have a bone to pick with evangelicalism have a bit of a point. And so they're trying to distance themselves with the religiosity of Christians in the past that has put people off. And I think we should too. So let's not try to sound like Bible-thumping, you know, fundamentalists if we can avoid it, even if that's what we are. Because there's no need to sound that way if it puts people off. If we can find another way to communicate the message, fine. So stay away from religious language and religious affect. 4, focus on the truth, not personal benefits of Christianity. Now, I could talk about this for a long time. I don't have time to. I got to get to the calls. But I appreciated the gentleman's approach, and he kept talking about truth. The one person was an Asian that he was talking to. The Asian said, well, I like reincarnation. And the guy said, well, you know, even if you like reincarnation, it isn't going to make it true if it's not true. Your liking something a certain way is not going to change reality. That was a great point. In other words, he was focusing on the truth claims of Christianity. He wasn't given a bunch of promises. He wasn't saying, Jesus is my ice cream. He's a great flavor. Try him to see if you like him. So focus on truth and not personal benefits. 5, give evidence. That's simple. And you'd expect me to say that. It stand to reason. This gentleman was given all kinds of evidence. Good for him. You should too. You know why? Because everybody else in the Bible did too. Jesus, Paul, Peter, everybody. You look at the details of how they communicated their faith, it's all there. In fact, if you want to get the content of the gospel simple, pure and simple, the most famous passage for the articulation of the gospel is in 1 Corinthians 15, at the beginning, where Paul says, I delivered to you as of first importance or whatever. Here's the gospel that I was handed to me, I'm passing on to you. Jesus died, resurrected. Etc. It's all right there. He gives all kinds of evidence according to the scriptures. Rose from the dead. We are witnesses. It's all right there in the gospel. We see that all the time. So give evidences. It's appropriate. People do respond to that even in a postmodern age. 6, stay calm. All right? Don't get mad. Don't get crazy. Don't get frustrated. Just stay calm. Keep your cool. The more calm you are, the more confident you look, the more persuasive you sound. All right? Fair enough. 7, let them walk away if they want. I guess you can call this don't bruise the fruit. When it seems like they're finished with the conversation, their eyes are wandering, they're calling for the flight attendant or, you know, looking for an exit, let them go. They are not listening anymore. I'm always alert when people seem to be getting tired of talking to me. And then I let them go. Because when they get tired, they are not listening anymore. And so you're wasting your effort and you're bruising the fruit. 8. And I think this is the last one. Leave them with something. Give them something. The gentleman here was giving out books, New Testaments, Gospel of John. I don't know. I think the Gospel of John is a good choice, or maybe the Gospel of Mark, but you usually can't get the Gospel of Mark by itself. That's an easier read, by the way. It's shorter. It's clearer. It's not as high a Christology. It's not so much to stumble over. And you don't have that confusing 10 verses in John chapter 1 to figure out what's going on. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and all that. But if you don't have that, Gospel of John is fine. Here, just read Jesus. Tell them. Hand them the Gospel. Say, just read it. Just let Jesus speak for himself. Leave him with that. Sometimes if I don't have that, I'll leave a business card. And not so that they can call me, but so that they can go to our website. Give them some way to make the next step, I guess is what I'm saying. And I think that you'll find it's not just the stone that you put in your shoe, but they've got some tangible way of following up on that. Okay, so once again, look for opportunities, 1. 2, don't give them too much. A lot of hooves to jump through. Just put a stone in their shoe. 3, stay away from religious terminology and affect. 4, focus on the truth, not personal benefits. 5, give them some evidence. 6, stay calm. 7, let them walk away if they want to walk away. Don't bruise the fruit. And eight, leave them something. Give them something so they can take the next step with. And I hope that will help you as a good ambassador for Christ. Okay, it's time to go to the phones. There are 714 area code lines open. If you are in that area code, 754-4150 is the direct number. And let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. And Joseph, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg, how are you doing?
I'm fine. In fact, at the end of the month, I think I'm going to be in Raleigh. That's the capital of your state, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to be out there on a special event.
Yeah, can I give you some kudos here before I get into...
Sure. Just always nice to hear those. Don't make them too long, though.
No, I sure won't. I just wanted to tell you how important the ABCs were to me. And
oh, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum. Right. Good.
And some of your other resources, and they're just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
They helped me tremendously.
That's great.
About a year ago, I had a real life-changing event, and I won't get into the details of it because it really doesn't matter. And but it was a very emotional type of thing, and what it did is it, because it was such an emotional thing, I had to find out whether or not it was true, and mm-hmm. it drove me into apologetics.
Mm.
And
were you a believer at the time, a follower of Christ, or no?
I was, but I had basically because I wasn't a strong believer.
Right.
Put it that way, I had been Catholic.
Mm-hmm. How'd you find SDR?
And I just was not a very grounded believer. I didn't have much knowledge or almost
okay.
nothing, basically.
How'd you find STR?
And
how did you find Stand to Reason?
Oh, through a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, what it was is it was one of the other stations that I listened to out here. A friend of mine told me about Hank Hanegraaff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard you on Hank.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I'm sure glad you found us, Joseph.
It was really a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, it just drove me, went from this emotional state into the digging as deep as I possibly could into the Scripture and finding out the truth. And the more that that happened, the more of the emotion kind of waned, and I got just so much stronger in my faith because of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I like to say that, you know, we focus on the issues in the mind, and people say, well, you're so logical, you know, you're not emotional. We have plenty of emotions to spare around Stand to Reason, I guarantee you that. But emotions make life enjoyable, delicious even, but it is careful thinking that makes life safe. And when you have a religious experience can be powerful and emotional, but it doesn't mean that it's safe. And that's where the thinking, the careful thinking, the tools that God has given us to be safe comes into play so we can assess that accurately. It looks like you got the best of both worlds there, Joe.
Yeah, it was really something. Anyhow.
So what's on your mind?
My quick question here is, it's regarding Bart Ehrman's book and a passage that he had in there. I haven't read the whole thing.
Okay, this fellow wrote Misquoting Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and his idea is that the Bible's full of errors kind of thing.
Right. You know, and I know better than that, and I've done some research on the one passage. I haven't read the entire book that he has, but mm-hmm. I cannot. And the adulterous woman passage out of
John 8, the beginning. It actually starts in chapter 7, verse 53.
Right.
And then goes down through verse 11. There's a section there, right?
Some research on that. I was wondering if you could add to it. I've just recently found out about that book and just breezed through it a little bit, but I've checked into a book that I have, the Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties.
Sure.
And they have some...
Gleason Archer.
Right. And they do talk about that passage in there that prior to the King James Version, it didn't show up. But with new manuscript evidence, it did. And I was just wondering if you could expand on that.
Well, unless you have more information than I mean, there might be something that's come out more recently. I've done a little work on it, but not a lot.
Okay.
But essentially, there are different families of manuscripts. That is, there are variations in the manuscripts of the copies of the Bible that we have now. Now, we got lots of copies. And so there are certain differences that show up characteristically in one set of copies and not another, and so you know that these are somehow related because the same variation was copied from early on or either left out or added or whatever, and so then you know that these are kind of related as a family of documents. And so the John 8, the woman caught in adultery where Jesus said, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." This was in the King James, which drew from a family of documents known as the broadly the Textus Receptus. But in terms of the Greek underlying Greek manuscript, it was more of a Byzantine text type is what they call it. Okay, these are later. These are old. These are more recent, these texts. And as time went on, after the King James was written, we found earlier manuscripts. Many of the earlier manuscripts did not have this account in them. And so this threw question onto the legitimacy of this account. Is this a genuine bona fide account? Did this really happen? Was it actually the real question that we're facing is not whether this really happened, but whether this was originally part of the Gospel of John. That's the real question here about the textual issues. Was this part of the Gospel of John that John wrote, or whoever wrote the gospel? I think it was John. But, you know, the point I'm making is, was it part of the original text, or was it added by someone later? Now, there are many more recent documents than there are older documents, right? Obviously, the older documents, there are fewer of them. The more recent, there's more of them. And so this Byzantine text type is called the majority text because there's a lot of them. And so some people say, well, most of the copies have this in it, so we think that's authentic. And others that say, yeah, there are fewer copies that don't, but the ones that don't are the oldest ones, and so they give priority to the older copy. Now, this is a bona fide, legitimate debate about the legitimacy of John chapter 8, the first 11 verses, as part of the original Gospel of John. I'm not exactly sure what the right answer is, but I'll tell you personally, I lean more towards the view that the earlier documents are probably more reliable. So I would tend to be skeptical that this was in the original. All right. Now, I don't know if you've got new information that there are early documents that have come in now that include this. That would be a surprise to me.
No, I don't. I have not found that.
Okay. It's the majority text that has this, not the earlier documents. Now, so this raises a question. Well, how did that get in there? And my answer is, well, I don't know if it got in there by – if it wasn't in the original, somebody must have put it in there. Now, are you very, very familiar with John chapter 8 in that first section? You've read that a few times, right?
Sure.
You're familiar with that passage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I asked myself a couple of questions about it. The first thing is I don't think if I had a bet money, I'd say this wasn't in the original Gospel of John. Okay, what of theological significance is in that passage? By the way, those 11 verses.
Say that again. What
in those 11 verses that are in question? Mm-hmm. What of theological significance is in there?
Well, not much, really.
There's nothing of theological significance in there. It is a clever story. If it's true, it tells us something about the cleverness of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But it tells us nothing about theology.
Right. All it does is speak about how he worked over the Pharisees.
He got himself out of a tight spot. Now, we've got other accounts that seem to be part of the original that tell us that also, and this is another clever one. In fact, when you read through the account, I would say it has a ring of truth to it. And what I mean by that is there are sections like this, a few of them, that are extra, that aren't in the oldest manuscripts. The long ending of Mark is an example, Mark 16. And
right.
Most
you know,
of your Bibles...
What's different about that, though, is that it wasn't really outlined in the, at least in the NASB when I looked at that, or the New King James.
They didn't indicate that this was in question?
I don't think so, no.
That surprises me, because most of your good Bibles will indicate that that's also in question.
Right, I expected that, and I didn't see it.
When I read the long ending of Mark, I think it's pretty clear that there is a change in voice between how Mark is writing up until the long ending, and then you got all that stuff at the end. I think it looks like a whole bunch of hodgepodge thrown in there. It doesn't sound like Mark. This sounds like John, or it sounds like Jesus, to put it simply. This account seems to fit. There's nothing unusual about this. This sounds like just the kind of move Jesus would make. So here's my opinion about this. My suspicion is this story is a true story, but it wasn't in the original. And somehow it was still in circulation in the oral tradition, and some scribe inserted it there later on. And then it got copied in the majority text. And so, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to stand on any point in this passage, nor need I, because there's nothing theological to stand on in the passage. There is no theological significance of any kind here. there is just some cleverness of Jesus, which might be interesting to reflect on, but nothing hinges on this. Now, some people have made a big deal about this. They've said, okay, as this author you mentioned, what's his name again?
Erdman.
Erdman.
Bart Erdman.
Yeah, Bart. They make a big deal about this in a couple of other passages. Oh, well, see, look at, what's the point of inerrancy if you don't have a good text? Well, that is a good point. And in fact, I'll concede that if the text is corrupt, significantly corrupted, then inerrancy is moot. You don't have the original anyway, so why care about whether the original is inerrant when you don't have it or you don't have anything close to it? However, as you probably know from your own studies, the discipline of textual criticism is quite sophisticated. And just because we have a chunk here out of John 8 that we have good reason to believe wasn't in the original doesn't mean that inerrancy is in question or that the corruption of the text is in question. We know. We have good reason to believe this isn't part of the original. And so we don't even take it into consideration. We remove it.
It was very easy to find that was an issue. It wasn't like it was hidden.
No, this is not a secret to anybody. We've known this for a long time. And so the answer is, can we reconstruct the original with a high degree of confidence? The answer is yes, and this wouldn't be in it. But since it's been in it for 350 years, you can't exactly just leave a big hole in the Bible. You got to include it because people expect it to be there, and you put in a little marginal reference that this wasn't part of the oldest manuscripts. So I don't think these kinds of things help us at all. Or let's put it this way, is a problem at all in the question of the authority of the text. These are non-issues. Some people can make it into big issues, and people who are inclined to be skeptical about these things can get all bent out of shape about it. But, I mean, okay, well, no, this seems like it was added. So does Mark 16. But most of the things in Mark 16, except for the poison and the snake handling stuff, are in other areas that are not in question, so we don't lose anything there. Look at the Bible has been reconstructed about 99.9% with full confidence, and the things that are left mean nothing. They carry no weight in terms of any theological questions. So I don't know what the big fuss is about this.
Yeah. Hey, I've got one really quick question.
Be real quick because I got to read.
Okay. Have you heard? You know, I'm familiar with generational sin, but have you heard anything to the effect of community sin?
No. Well, I haven't heard about it, but there may be something to that in a sense. I'd have to spend some other time to talk about it, but I will say as categorically, as a generalization, properly understood, there is no such a thing as generational sin. The way people understand that concept, there is no such thing. This is a complete fabrication. I think people must understand some things that are written in the Old Testament, and then they've gone off on the deep end in this, and the misunderstanding is easy to correct, and unfortunately whole ministries have been built around this notion.
Yeah, I understand it completely. I just hadn't heard of community sin.
Yeah, there are. Well, God holds nations responsible for their sins, if you want to think, because it talks in terms like that in the scriptures. Now, how that all plays out is another issue. I'll have to deal with that another day. Joe, thanks for your call from North Carolina. I got to move on to other callers. Actually, we got a break coming up, and then I'll be back right here on Stand to Reason. Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers, Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will MC all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea. And he told us of his life in the land of submarines.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And speaking of sailing, yeah, coming up here. In September, of course, you know about our cruise, September 16th through 23rd, Boston, Bar Harbor, Halifax, Sydney, Charlton, Quebec City, and Montreal, a week with Jay Richards and Kirby Anderson and myself as we're teaching you while you're afloat. And then when we get in port, you're out visiting these wonderful ports. We've been talking about it for 6 months or so now. What you may not be aware of is this is the last week that you can sign up in, a week from tomorrow? Is that they're giving up we have to give up all the cabins that we've reserved so they can sell them to other people. And as it turns out, we still have a week to go. So please, if you've been thinking about doing the cruise with us, you have to move right away. This isn't a sales technique. It's not a pressure selling. It's just letting you know the facts of the matter here. We would love to have you on board with us. And this is the last week to sign up. So go to our website at sdr.org, and the cruise information is on our homepage, and you could link through to get all of the details and the numbers and whatever so that you can participate and be part of taking a vacation with us to New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall, September 16th through 23rd, and be around people of kindred spirit who love the Lord and who care about a thoughtful faith as well. So I'd love to have you show up. You just have to do the action this week and get it squared away. Also, right after the show today, I'll be here in Southern California in the Huntington Beach area at Calvary Baptist Church. I'll be teaching on Truth is a Strange Sort of Fiction. Broadly, I want to help people understand the emerging culture and the emerging church that is seeking to communicate the gospel to that culture. This is in the Huntington Beach area. We're starting at 6 o'clock, though, so if you're in the area, you need to get moving right around the time I'm finished with the show here. For more information, contact 714, area code 962-6860. Will they be able to get information now about how to get to that church at that number? It's Calvary Baptist Church in Huntington Beach. Calvary Baptist Church in Huntington Beach. And so if you have trouble finding information, just Google that up. I'm sure you'll find their homepage. And I'll be starting at 6 o'clock with that talk. And then on Thursday the 15th, that's Thursday next week, I'll be at Biola in their apologetics series, and I'll be talking about the bankruptcy of moral relativism. That starts at 7 in the evening at Biola University. The number there, 888, that's toll-free, 332-4652, 332-4652. Hope you can make it for one or both of those events this week. Okay, back to the phones, and let's talk with Aaron in Chino, California. Aaron, hi. Greg,
how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Great ministry. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Don't let up.
Thank you. Okay.
I wanted to ask you, my wife and I, we love, we love Starbucks coffee, and we just recently found out this periodical that Starbucks and some other corporations advocate, and they give money to just different types of agenda, like the pro-gay and lesbian agenda, mm-hmm. pro-abortion agendas. And I want to know, if you can give me some input, what is your take on what would constitute grounds for you either boycotting or just not being a patron of one of these types of companies?
Well, here, a couple of thoughts. I don't think that if you patronize an organization that you are participating in the immoral actions of that organization. We could talk more about this, but I actually think there's a commentary on boycotting on our website. You just kind of do a topic search on that. But because if that were the case, then every time that you bought something at Ralph's grocery store, you would be participating in the immorality of anybody that was kind of the recipient of pay or income related to that. It seems to me you're removed from that kind of thing. Now, sometimes it's the product itself that's wrong. So if you're going to pornography store or something like that, well, your money is purchasing something that is morally suspect, and so I think that's a different circumstance. I also think my wife and I don't eat veal, all right? And the reason we don't eat veal is because of the way veal is raised.
Right.
And so the more veal we buy, the more little calves have to be raised that way. And it seems to me that there is a more direct relationship between my purchase of that product and the kind of treatment that those animals receive, you know. So there's another kind of example. We'd make a choice. Now, it might be that we'd want to make a protest vote. What I've just argued a moment ago was about morality and whether I think that we are somehow morally participating I don't think we're morally participating. When we buy their product, I don't think we're morally participating in the thing that they use their money to promote. All right. Now, that's kind of the moral equation. However, you might say, you know what? I don't like that they do that, so I'm not going to buy their coffee. That's completely an individual situation. I don't think you're morally obliged.
I see. Okay.
But you are certainly morally free to do that and to make a statement.
Okay.
You are free to withhold your in a sense dollar vote from that organization because you want to make a different kind of statement. So that's an individual thing, and I'm trying to think if there are things that we won't purchase because of that. I don't know if we have other alternatives. You know,
I'm just thinking like some hybrid.
Our son works at Starbucks, by the way, and I don't think
I got a cousin that works there too. Yeah, I love the coffee. My wife
because he works at Starbucks. A lot of labor unions have political positions that some people think are immoral. Does that mean that if you're part of that labor union, that you are somehow participating in that? No, you don't promote that. You're not approving it. You know, I think there's a freedom there. And when it comes to the personal things, I guess it just depends in any given situation what I'm faced with, what we're going to do. We probably aren't going to stop drinking Starbucks coffee. All right. But for when we get it free from our son, he gets a free pound every week, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
But there are other alternatives if somebody has wanted to. Pete's coffee is sensational. There you go, Aaron. There's a quick analysis of that. We've got an hour ahead of us, and I'll be taking more of your calls. 1-800-227-5278. And those lines open in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Those lines are open as well. And I look forward to another hour with you straight ahead on Stand to Reason. Hour number two here at Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, back from vacation and refreshed, ready to take on the world. And you at 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Hey, congratulations to Christina Madsen of Polson, Montana. That's what MT stands for, right? Montana. She is this week's Frapper winner. And I just signed the book this afternoon on Melinda's desk so that it can be sent out, a personal copy of, in this case, of Relativism. We send out a different gift each week to someone whose name we pull out of a hat that is part of our kind of listening community, radio listening community, whether it's, you know, through regular radio or through podcasting on the internet. We draw from names of people who have stuck a pin in our map to indicate that they're part of our listening community, and you can do that by just going to our website. And Frapper is the – that's F-R-A-P-P-R – is the software and or the company that provides the map and the ability to put a pin on it. And our listening audience is growing all the time, or at least the number of people on our – on our map all over the country. And so if you check that out on our website, you can register as well, and your name will also go into the hat. And it's all over the world, as the enforcer just corrected me. All over the world, people are listening. And you can see, you know, we got people in Europe and in Iraq and in Down Under and New Zealand and all over. So if you'd like to do that, go ahead and register, and then your name will go into the hat. And every week we pull out another winner, and this week it's Christina Madston from Polson, Montana. Also, good news. We've been waiting for a long time to do this, and my handy-dandy, very efficient staff has accomplished this recently. Now, not only can you purchase product from Stand to Reason by having the product mailed to you in CD or tape form, but now we have MP3s that are posted, so for a discount, you could just have the MP3 downloaded, and you could put it in your iPod or burn your own disc. So you'll save yourself some money and some shipping fees if you do it that way, and you can and get it instantly. So go to our website and check out some of the things that we have now. Not every single thing is available in MP3, but many of our things are. And thanks to our hardworking staff that got that in order to make it easier for you. And that also means no matter where in the world you are listening, you can download this right away. Okay? You don't have to have it shipped overseas. And we're hoping this is going to make it easier for people all over the world to be using now many of the things that people in the United States have had for practical reasons most of the access to. So that's good news. All right, before I get to the calls, 1-800-227-5278. Lines open there. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. I started out talking last hour about some tips and guidelines about being a better ambassador that were taken just from me kind of eavesdropping in on some conversations on the airplane coming back from my trip to Wisconsin. I also just got back from San Jose last night. I was there for 3 days, so I got in on Tuesday from Wisconsin, and Wednesday left for San Jose for a investors conference, stock market investors. So totally secular enterprise kind of thing. But that's an opportunity for me, even though I'm largely focused on something else. That's an opportunity for me to be like you are in the marketplace of ideas and alert as an ambassador for opportunities that might come up, as I suggested that you should be. Where I can reflect something about Christianity and see what happens. And there were two things that happened while I was there, and I want to tell you very briefly about both of them. That is two conversations I got into that and they were each very different. And this is kind of a way of applying, talking about in application of the kinds of points that I made last hour about looking for opportunities, not giving them too much to deal with right away, staying away from religious affect and language, focusing in on the truth, giving some evidence if possible, staying calm, giving them something when they walk away, don't bruise the fruit, that kind of stuff. Now, those eight steps that I gave you last hour, you're not going to be able to go through with them all. And the reason is one of them says don't bruise the fruit and let them walk away. And sometimes they walk almost immediately, right? They get wind of what you're up to, and they're gone. They're not interested, so you can't give them anything. You can't put a stone in their shoe. There's no shoe left to put a stone into. They're out of here. Why? If people want to walk, I let them walk. And so sometimes I might start into a conversation probing, tossing out a little bait, you know, some chum like the fisherman, you know, toss out a lure, see if I get a nibble, as it were. And if I don't, I let it go. And in one of the seminars that I was at this week, there was a woman sitting right next to me from Australia, actually, traveled all the way to the States for this seminar. And we were in conversation, whatever, and somewhere along the line, the seminar ended, and we were talking a little bit, and she asked me something about what I do, which is what people frequently do in situations like that. It's not uncommon. And I told her, and I have different ways of characterizing what I do at Stand to Reason, but in any event, when she heard that I was engaged in a religious enterprise, and it was Christianity, she said, well, I prefer Buddhism. I meditate a lot. Okay, so now I'm religious. She's religious, okay? This is, I mean, thinking from her perspective. Now, I can't leave it lie there, as you probably could imagine. I'm not going to say, oh, good, you're spiritual too. See, we're both spiritual. That's really what's great, because that isn't great. Doesn't matter how spiritual you are. It only matters whether you've got your spiritual commitments invested in the right place. So how can I get that across to her? So she's, okay, so what I say is, so I asked her a question, Colombo tactic. I said, do you think Buddhism is the accurate way to look at the world? So now that's the truth question, right? What I talked about earlier. Talk about the truth. Do you think that's true? Although I didn't use that word, I used a different phrase that might be a little bit more palatable at that moment. She said, yes, I do. Okay, now what? Okay, well, I said, okay, then I bring Jesus up. Now I want to bring Jesus into the picture and let her fight be with Jesus and not with me. So I simply said, well, if Buddha was right, Jesus was wrong. You know, when you say something like that, the person in the conversation immediately knows that you are not one of these people that's going to give the nod to anybody's spirituality and say, that's cool, whatever it is. Because I said, if Buddha was right, Jesus was wrong. We're back to the truth issue, right? And when I said that, I can immediately see her eyes, I should say, I could see her eyes kind of immediately glaze over. It was like, oh, yeah, okay, I know what this is all about. You know, I'm not patting her on the back for her spirituality. And she just said, well, no, I don't think that's the right way to look at it. And as she's saying that, she's gathering up her things, preparing to leave. And then she says, well, I don't think it matters what you believe. And then got up and left. So she was extricating herself from that circumstance. I was looking for an opportunity. I got into a conversation just far enough for this person to realize she did not want to have this conversation with me, and off she went. And I just said in parting, well, thanks, nice talking to you, you know, it was just friendly, whatever, and that was the end of that. She didn't say anything in return. She was gone. So this was not a fruitful divine encounter in one sense. I don't think it was a failure. It was just like this wasn't happening. God wasn't going anywhere with this person at this point, so I wasn't going to bruise the fruit. I let her go. But, you know, much could be said about her comment. You know, I realized it wasn't worthwhile to pursue anything more in her case, but think about what she says. It doesn't matter what you believe. I mean, that's an odd statement. It doesn't matter what you believe when it comes to religion? By the way, that statement itself was a statement of belief about how the religious project works. And I bet you she really believes it does matter what you believe about that. Because I'm sure she wasn't willing to say, well, it doesn't matter what you believe. You are a person who thinks that Jesus is the only way and everybody else is wrong. And I don't. And that's okay. No, I think she probably considered me amiss. Misled, mistaken, and she right on this one, and so she wasn't going to waste her time with me, and she moved on. So the it doesn't matter what you believe belief did matter, even to her, I suspect. Now, that was one conversation, okay? So non-Christian one, Kokel zero at that point, right? Okay, then I have another conversation. A young man started talking to me about details of the conference, and I mentioned to him, well, you know, I just graduated last week from a program that I'd been pursuing for a number of years, and so it's freed up more time for me to give some attention to this trading issue, with stock trading, which we were talking about. And he said, oh, really, what'd you graduate with a degree in? I said, well, I got a second master's degree. It was in the area of philosophy of religion and ethics. Now, one of the reasons I mentioned about graduating is because it did pertain to our conversation, but I also thought that it might provoke a query from him, which it did. Really? Oh, what was the field? What was your degree? Now, I told him. Now, when you say you graduate with a degree of philosophy, religion, and ethics, I think that some people think that's interesting or curious, and indeed he did, and it led to another comment. And his comment was, well, I guess that helps you to – that's a diversion from the corporate world. Now, he assumed that I was in the corporate world and that I got my degree in philosophy just as a diversion. And I said, well, no, this is my corporate world. I mean, this is in my area. Really, it is. What does this have to do with what you do? And I said, well, what philosophy does is it gives me the tools to think more carefully about the things that really matter. Issues like truth and religion and morality. I mean, this stock stuff, this is it plays a part, but it's not important in the big sense. In the final analysis, this isn't important. But the philosophy degree helps me to think more carefully about what really is important. And that's when he asked me what I did. And I explained to him a little bit about what I did, and he said, you know, this really intrigues me. Tell me more. It was amazing. All of a sudden, the stock market was not important to him. We had been talking about that before and some things, and now he really – so here it is. I've got my opportunity. This is a sheep who lifts his head, so to speak. That sheep didn't go on eating grass like the other one. This is one that lifted his head. And so now I had a conversation. Now what am I going to do with this opportunity? And am I going to hit him over the head with the Bible, give him a million things to think about? No, I'm going to give him something simple. I'm going to give him something to think about, something to chew on. I'm going to put a stone in his shoe. He asked me what I did and what I was about, and so I began to explain it. And I said, you know, people treat religious claim. You're an engineer, right? Yeah, okay, because he had said that earlier. See, you care about particulars and about how things work, you know, and about getting things right in certain circumstances. And he said, but when it comes to religion, people treat it like ice cream. I said, you know, like it doesn't matter. Well, you believe one thing, he believes another, it's all the same. I said, but when you think about it, religions make claims. They say certain things are so, and those things either are or aren't. This is what I said to him. I mean, for example, the Jews think that Jesus is not the Messiah, and the Christians think that he is. Now, he either is or he isn't. You know, when I said that, he started laughing like he thought, well, that's obvious. So it does matter what you believe. And if it turns out that religion has significant consequences in people's lives, which seems that it does, at least arguably, then you know, we shouldn't be throwing up our hands at this. And I said, I think Jesus was the Messiah. I'm a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. And I think his picture of the world was an accurate one. And I think if it was, then boy, that makes a difference for the way all of us ought to be living. He said, yeah, but that happened so many years ago. How can you know those things? I said, well, you're right. There is a problem. It happened so long ago. But that's a problem that my field is there to help us to overcome, because there's ways to work with that. It isn't like we don't know anything about the past. Sometimes broader worldview considerations come into this. I mean, some religions think God is personal. Some religions think God is not personal. Well, he's not both. And if my belief in Jesus as the Messiah fits into a larger worldview, which worldview can be defended and seems to be reasonable, then that adds more credibility to the smaller claims embedded in that worldview. Now, he followed this completely. I'm not face-to-face with him, banging on my Bible, preaching the gospel to him. This is pre-evangelism. I'm just getting him warmed up to the idea that this might be worth thinking about. And we're having a casual conversation. It's very comfortable. He is obviously interested in what I have to say. Now, there came a point when his eyes started to drift, and I thought he's starting to tire a little bit. And I didn't want to wear him out. And so I kind of closed it off. Now, if he wanted to follow it a little bit more, he could do so, but he didn't. But he told me, he said, this is the most intelligent conversation I've ever had with anyone about religion. I said, well, I'm glad. This is what we're trying to accomplish here at Stand to Reason. We want it to be more like diplomacy than D-Day. We want you to think about these things because I think Christianity is worth thinking about. And then I gave him my card. Now, why did I give him my card? Because I wanted him to leave him with something. I wanted to give him another step. And in fact, I had information that I collected at the seminar that I'd typed out on my computer that I was going to email him. So I got his name and his email. So now I have a connection with him. I'm going to do him a favor by sending him something he wants. That's a set of notes from one of these sessions on trading. So we'll be able to correspond or communicate in the future. In the meantime, he's got my card so that he can go to our website and take a look at some things. And maybe that will pique his curiosity even further. So I left him with something, a place to go. I've got his name. I can follow up. And I didn't bruise the fruit. So I think you can see in that conversation some of the things that I, in play, that I talked about last hour that I hope will be helpful to you. I don't know what's going to happen with the girl from New Zealand. Maybe she'll do her meditating to the end of her life and will never consider Christ. Maybe she'll come to her senses somewhere down the line and God will use another ambassador to penetrate. But I didn't bruise the fruit. I took a shot. Didn't work out. Fine. I'm moving on to somebody else. I'm looking for the person who's looking for me. And I found somebody. And we had a nice, pleasant conversation, and I gave him something worth thinking about. I put a stone in his shoe. I gave him a card. I got some follow-up, and I'm going to let him stew on that for a while and chew on that for a while and see what the Lord does. At least that's my approach. All right, to the phone. Time for a break? Okay, I'll go to a break right now, and then I will come back to Brad in Albany, New York, and then Pat has a question about whether it's okay to rejoice in Zarqawi's death. Yippee! Well, I'll tell you the answer to that in a moment. Coming back to you after this break here on Stand to Reason, I'm Greg Kokel. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, well, I've got great news for you. After more than a year in development, the brand new Stand to Reason interactive training series on tactics in defending the faith is now available on DVD. Included are 6 one-hour sessions where I train you step-by-step in valuable, easy-to-use, time-tested techniques that keep you in the driver's seat when talking with others. It's perfect for home groups, for Sunday school, for Bible studies, for homeschooling, with interactive discussion questions, role-playing, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, and a leader guide and a 100-page comprehensive workbook that you can reproduce for each member of your group. Now, if you learn best by listening, mentoring CDs are available, but the best combination is to get them both. Then you'll have the DVD training course, the mentoring CDs to listen to in the car or on your iPod, and the comprehensive 100-page workbook. Now, the special pre-order price through the end of the month is $39.95. After that, it'll be $50, so order now. The Tactics DVDs will ship by the end of the month. Go to our website at str.org or call us at 1-800 the number 2 and the word reason. Don't delay. str.org or 1-800-2-REASON.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here. Stand to Reason is the show. Clear thinking Christianity, ladies and gentlemen, that's my goal here. Giving you something worth thinking about every Sunday from 3 until 5. Los Angeles time. I say that because if you are not listening to live streaming, which is available on the KBRT website, then you have to call having listened to a podcast or something like that, and you're not sure when this is happening. So you got to call during the live show Sundays, 3 to 5, Los Angeles time. 1-800-227-5278 is our number. To our callers now, let's go to, Brad in Albany, New York. Brad, thanks for waiting.
It's actually Kentucky.
Oh, it's Kentucky.
It's a small town.
But it is Albany, Kentucky.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Thanks for the correction. You don't sound like you're from New York anyway.
All right.
You sound more like a Kentucky boy, okay?
All right. But, sir, I actually want to say first that your organization is just wonderful, and that's why for the past 2 years I've contributed to it financially because it's helped me so much.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks, Brad.
One of the questions I had was that kind of deals with original sin, mm-hmm. and I had a college professor this past year that it was agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
However, he subscribed to, I'd say, original sin. He believed that people were naturally evil in a way,
mm-hmm.
and of course, he believed that this is something that we have innate within us, and that since if it's something we have in us, then if God does exist, God put it in us, and therefore God's naturally demented. What kind of argument would you use to combat that?
Well, it simply doesn't follow that if there is something that is, in a certain sense, innate, and that term needs to be qualified, and I'll qualify it in a minute, just because it's – well, let's put it this way. Just because it's universal, that God caused it that way. Let me give you an illustration. Let's just say the first human being was warned – or let me back it up and put it this way. Let's just say you were warned that if you took acid, all right, that you would have – it would create damage to your body, all right? And so you decided to take acid, and indeed it damaged your body. In fact, it caused chromosome problems such that all of the children that you now had this chromosomal damage, and this was expressed in some kind of congenital defect. And consequently, every child that they would have the same defect. So now you have in all of your progeny a congenital defect that each person has, and that is part of their physical constitution. Okay, or you could call it innate at that point, that for everyone following you in your subsequent progeny, it is innate for them to have this congenital defect. So now we have a defect that is innate to the physical constitution of a whole line of people. Does it follow then that it is God that created that defect? What do you think?
It makes sense to me.
What I'm talking about is kind of a logical entailment here, and this is what's important, because your professor has made a claim that it must be this way, and I'm trying to show you an illustration that it doesn't follow from the evidence, the conclusion that he's offered. And the illustration I've offered is that here's this thing. It doesn't follow that because there's this congenital defect that God caused it, because we know God didn't cause it in my illustration, and it's a perfectly plausible illustration. We know that you caused it. You did something you were told not to do that had consequence on your progeny, and all the progeny subsequent to that were influenced by that, but it was you that did it, not God. And in the Christian account of original sin, it wasn't God who made this innate in human beings. In fact, God created man good. It was something that man did that then influenced the rest of the progeny. So now, I mean, it's certainly possible when you think about if we all have innate sin, that it's possible God created us this way. But in the Christian account of original sin, this is not what happened. God didn't create us this way. It is something that man chose to do that influenced the rest of his progeny. So in the Christian account, God is not responsible for this, and there is nothing about having it innate in the sense that original sin is innate in all human beings, that logically makes God responsible. He is choosing, your professor, he is choosing to believe that God's responsible, but there is no reason to believe that he is. It isn't as if whenever you have a quote-unquote innate characteristic, it must be God that caused it, because our illustration shows that that doesn't follow. And in fact, in the Christian accounting of the fall, that wasn't follow either. So your professor's making a point. Look, what if I said to your professor, professor, you have, let's see, what would be a, you have, professor, I'm trying to think of an illustration. I'm just going to pull something corny out of the air. Say, professor, you have bad breath. That's your wife's fault. Your wife must be an awful light wife because you have bad breath. Now, can I construct a scenario in which it would be his wife's fault that he had bad breath? Sure. But it certainly doesn't have to have been that way. It could be some other reason he has bad breath. So if I looked at his bad breath and I said, your wife must be awful, he'd say, you have no good reason to believe my wife is awful. Because just because it's possible my wife is responsible for my bad breath, it doesn't mean that she is responsible, in fact. Somebody else, a whole host of other reasons might be responsible for it. So you're not justified in drawing that conclusion. And by the same token, it may be the case that theoretically God could be responsible for original sin, but there are other ways to account for it as well that leaves God off the hook. And therefore, no one is justified in concluding that God must be responsible just simply in virtue of the existence of original sin. Does it make more sense there?
Right. So basically, you're saying is it like a original sin or natural sin nature? Is it like a would the equivalent be like a physical like a gene that you pass on to your child?
I think it could be characterized something like that because we know that Adam didn't have this inclination before he did what he was told not to do. And then after he did have this inclination, which he then did pass on to his children. To talk about it passing on like a genetic variation or something like that or a handicap is just an illustrative way of explaining it. I don't exactly know the ontology of it. How does that get passed on? I don't know, but it does get passed on. And the originator was not God but Adam in the Christian account of things. So the Christian account can't be faulted in this way. That's what I'm saying. My main point here is not to explain how sin gets passed on, but to demonstrate that your professor's argument does not go through. So you don't have to, in a sense, his argument is a bad argument, and that's all that needs to be addressed. Nothing has to be addressed about Christianity. What has to be demonstrated is that his argument doesn't go through. It simply doesn't follow that because original sin is somehow innate, that God is therefore responsible and he must be awful. This is just bad thinking.
All right.
And that's the way I would approach it. And certainly in the Christian account, God isn't responsible, so there's no reason to fault Christianity in that way. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Yes, it does.
Okay. Okay, Brad. Oh, you have another question.
The question I had was kind of dealing with the first callers, the Bart Ehrman.
Yes.
The professor from North Carolina.
Right.
I was reading the article in Christianity Today of last month, and he was talking about how originally he believed that the Bible was inerrant.
Yes.
But he found a contradiction or a contradiction that made him believe it wasn't, and it deals with Mark chapter 2, verse 26.
Uh-huh.
And how he talks about Abathar, I guess how to pronounce it, as the high priest.
Abathar, the high priest at the time of David, and how David ate the consecrated bread. Jesus is speaking here, talks about David eating the consecrated bread during the time of that high priest.
Yes, sir.
And then apparently went back to the 1 Samuel account and found out that Abathar was not the high priest during that time. Somebody else was.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, just a couple of thoughts here. A broad procedural whenever you have a problem with an alleged contradiction like that, it's always good to go to Gleason Archer's Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties, okay? Because sometimes these are explained and resolved there, all right? But the second thing is this. This is a broad procedural thing. And that is, just because it looks like a contradiction doesn't mean it is a contradiction, all right? Contradiction is when both things cannot be true at the same time. All right?
Okay.
So, I'm trying to think, during the time of Jesus, I'm going to give you a potential way that this might be resolved. I don't know how this particular problem is resolved, but I'm going to give you a potential way. All right? Sometimes when there is a transition from one high priest to the other, you know, just like there's a transition from president to president.
Right.
You know, when George Bush was elected in November, but he swore in January, right?
Right.
Okay, in November, what is he called between November and January?
Was it like in
president-elect, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so he's president-elect. Now, he's not exercising his powers as president, but he's president-elect. And there is some role, in it, not exactly authority, but he's certainly involved in the process of the in the transition, correct?
Right.
Okay, so there's an overlap. Now, of course, with our Constitution, that overlap severely restricts his responsibilities and his powers until such time as he actually swears into the oath of office. And when he does, then he's the president and the former president is now the former president kind of thing. But in the case of things like high priest here, and also in the case of kings in the Old Testament in different countries, like in Nebuchadnezzar and, you know, the people like that in their countries, there was an overlap with kingship. And even, I think, in Israel, there was a time of overlap. And so there was a transition from one to the other. And during that time, sometimes the old guy was called the king, and sometimes the new guy was called the king. And in the transition between the high priest, sometimes the old guy was called the high priest, and sometimes the new guy was called the high priest. So you're going to get accounts that says in the Old Testament one guy was king, and other places where it says a different guy was king, when the fact of the matter is they both were.
Okay.
And now I'm not saying that this is exactly the case with this problem. I don't know. I haven't researched it. But what I am saying is you can't just look at circumstances like this and say, well, there it is, an obvious contradiction. Because it may very well be that somebody refers to President Bush as President Bush because he's the president-elect and he hasn't sworn in, but he still could be, in a sense, called the president. He's called Mr. President, even though somebody else is the president too. So who's the president? Well, in different senses, they both are, and there's no contradiction. And by the same token, sometimes that's what you find in the scriptures here.
Okay.
There's always a possibility that a scribe made an error. Maybe this is a scribal error. Okay, what follows from that? That sometimes there's scribal errors. It doesn't follow that the original is not inerrant. And remember, inerrancy only applies to the original. Okay. And when we and we can say the same of the copies insofar as we have good reason to believe that the copies are completely accurate to the original. When we don't think the copies are completely accurate to the original, like when we talked about John 8 last hour, then we can't say that that passage is inerrant. It doesn't mean that nothing is inerrant, that nothing is reliable. And that's the mistake that people like this gentleman, this author, have made, I think.
All right.
Now, if the Bible was absolutely thick with these kinds of things, well, then I think it's okay. Then I think you'd have a case. But the Bible isn't thick with these kinds of things, either textual errors or contradictions. And the list of alleged contradictions was much longer in the past, and it's much shorter now because many of these things have been resolved. So I still think we have every reason to believe that the text is reliable and inspired. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I mean, actually, both the contradictions people point to, I've actually found a reasonable explanation for them. And I've actually done a little bit of research on this, and I've heard in some of the books I have, they'll talk about it. And I just wanted to hear your opinion.
Yeah, did what I say match to what some of the books said?
Well, actually, I like your first the first part you said about how it could be the same in a different sense. That was an answer I haven't came across yet, and it actually does make a lot for me.
Yeah, there's no overlap. Now, I'm just talking about a kind of a species of solution here. I know that applies in some cases, like to kings who are reigning, and there's a co-regency. The son, like when the son takes over for the father, there's actually a time of co-regency, and both are considered kings, and that solves some of the problems. I'm not saying that that's the solution to this one because I haven't researched that, but it may be something like that. Now, if I can't solve this, I'm not going to lose any sleep about it.
Right.
Because my unanswered question about this passage is not going to be adequate to overcome all of the evidence that I have to the contrary about the authority of the Scripture. Look at Jesus believed, if the historical account of Jesus' life is reasonably correct, if the kinds of things that he said about the Old Testament Scriptures are actually the kinds of things he really said, what we see recorded in the Gospels, then it seems Jesus had a very, very high view of Scripture. That is, he believed that the Old Testament Scriptures were God's Word. Now, if that's the case, then what do I think about Jesus based on the other things I know about him? Well, he made these claims, and then he did these miracles, and he rose from the dead. This is a guy that ought to know.
Right.
So I want to have the same view of the Old Testament Scriptures that Jesus had. Now, I don't know what Jesus would have made of this passage, but I tell you one thing. I bet he's the one who's talking right now in Mark chapter 2, and I bet you he wasn't. He's a pretty smart guy, and he knew the Old Testament pretty well. And, you know, I don't think that Bart, what's his name, is the first guy to ever figure this out, to see, well, there seems to be a difference there. I think probably if there was a problem, Jesus would have been aware of it. But there wasn't, and that's why he said it the way it was. It's kind of like the genealogy in Luke and the genealogy in Matthew. Oh, they contradict. They're different. Yeah, they're different. Do you think anybody in the last 2,000 years, especially people around that time, saw that too? Do you think Luke didn't see that? It's because it didn't bother them, because they realized that one was the genealogy of Jesus and the other one was the genealogy of Mary. I'm sorry, genealogy of Joseph in Matthew and the genealogy of Mary in Luke. And that makes all kinds of sense. So, I mean, it isn't like these people didn't seem to, you know, they didn't have to struggle with this. It didn't bother them for a reason, because it probably wasn't a contradiction. And so I have a couple of ways. They knew something we didn't know, is what I'm suggesting. And so we have a couple of ways of kind of approaching this. But I think the approach that Jesus, what was Jesus' view of the Old Testament, is an important one. And even if I can't answer this question, I do know that Jesus had a high view of the Scriptures, the Old Testament. And Jesus worked miracles, and he rose from the dead, and he claimed to be God. So I don't think he's probably going to, I think he's probably the one that's right. And Bart, what's his name, is the guy who's mistaken.
Right.
All right. I mean, so that's another way to approach it. I appreciate your call, Brad.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay. All the best to you. Time to go to break. Is that it? Okay. Break. And then we'll talk with Pat about Zarqawi. 1-800-227-5278. Right here on Stand to Reason.
Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers. Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will emcee all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night. I should be sleeping.
All right, friends. I like this kind of music, you know, coming back in. Once in a while, you hear something like this on the radio, and it just takes you back, and you think, you know, I'd like to listen to that whole song. But you can't, because this is my last segment. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And want to continue taking your calls at 1-800-227-5278. There's room there and time if you'd like to call in. If you're in the 714 area code here in Southern California, 754-4150 is the local number. Let's go to Pat. And, Pat, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Thank you. haven't heard from you in a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, nice.
Only for the sake of curiosity, have you picked up Ann Coulter's new book, Godless, The Church of Liberalism?
No, I didn't. I don't really follow that. Melinda reads all that stuff. I don't know. Have you read – well, she's on the phone right now, but maybe she's read Coulter's book. I did catch something as I was breezing through a USA Today that was left at my hotel room door there a couple days ago that – apparently she made some comment about the wives of 9/11 that really got her in hot water. It sounded to me like it was ill-advised, but
I mean, she's got a strong bite, you know.
She does. That's true.
But the chapter on abortion, when I was reading it last night, I was thinking about Stand to Reason,
mm-hmm.
and I thought the chapter was very good.
Good. What did it sound like? Us?
Well, I'm,
is that why you thought about it?
Yeah.
Us. Okay.
And there's two really good chapters on intelligent design versus evolution.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Well researched, but that's not why I called, of course. Hey, by the way, was that your earlier, your yippee? Can you do that again?
I was showing my hand a little bit regarding the issue that I think you want to ask about. Yeah. Melinda was also a little surprised, but go ahead and ask your question, and then you'll hear me.
After listening last week to conservative talk shows and Ansgar Karlwood's death, it seems to me we have something of a paradox, at least as Christians. I mean, my immediate response, and this is what I heard from, you know, people like Prager and Medved and somebody even like Hugh Hewitt.
Mm-hmm.
The immediate response was, you know, this is a great day. This
mm-hmm.
is a time to rejoice, to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking to a friend about this, a fellow Christian. And so we thought, you know, as Christians, you know, my thinking in accordance to the revealed propositions in Scripture
mm-hmm.
tells me that, you know, step back for a moment and think, this man just stepped into eternity.
Mm-hmm.
He was deceived, and now he knows the truth. And is this something to rejoice over? With that said, I mean, I understand.
Well, yeah, this is a very good point, and I will tell you quite candidly my response.
Okay.
And that was when I saw the piece in the U.S. Today or whatever in the newspaper, I actually can't remember exactly what I said then, but I thought, yippee. I was really glad, and I'm going to explain that in just a moment. When I saw my wife and we were talking, I said, it looks like they got Zarqawi. And then I said, you know, something about him being in the deepest reaches of hell, which is where he belongs.
Yep.
Now, I'll tell you what else I thought when I said that, and this is where I have mixed feelings about this kind of thing. I thought that's where I belong too. And when a person goes to hell, it is not a bad thing; it's a good thing. And the reason I can say that confidently is because God is sending him there, and God never does anything bad. He does something good. Now, there is a tragic element that someone made in the image of God for something so much more wonderful used what God gave him in such a terrible way that God must punish him forever. And that's true of all that go to hell. But hell is not a bad place. It's a good place. It's where justice is accomplished and God does a good thing. So I understand that there is a sense in which we are, you know, there are conflicting emotions. Was Zarqawi, on balance, here I'm speaking in human terms, a good man or a bad man? He was a terrible man. He was an awful, brutal man, and he did awful, brutal, evil things, almost unspeakable things. And so when his ability to continue doing that evil was stopped, that was a good thing. That he was killed is a good thing on that measurement. And so that's why I think when a good thing like that happens, we can rejoice in that good thing. That he goes to hell is a good thing because God is doing that thing and God doesn't do anything that's good. And there is a sense which we can applaud that in the sense that I just described. There is also a tragedy when someone good goes bad so much that he has to be punished. That is also part of the equation. And you and I, Pat, and I know you so I can say this, have gone bad. And we deserve no less in a certain sense than he did. So there but for the grace of God go you and I, Pat. And so there's a sense of certain humility that we have to be aware of. We are guilty too. Even though maybe we're not as bad as Zarqawi, we're not as good as Jesus, and we're probably more like Zarqawi than we are like Christ.
Well, you know what's interesting is...
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. There was a caller that called in to Prager the day after we found out about...
yeah, so it would be Thursday or Friday.
Yeah, and this youth minister, I think, opened my eyes to this. And then I called a friend to talk about it and pray about it. And, you know, how are we going to respond to people given this, the talk of the day, the days to come? And what was interesting is he said, I understand... Our emotional response is to rejoice. And, I mean, look, I mean, justice has occurred. Mm-hmm. Many lives will now be saved because this man is gone. And he said, but yet why is it when I rejoice, my conscience, I feel guilty? There's something.
Well, you only should feel guilty if you do something wrong.
Right.
Sometimes people have oversensitive consciences. Exactly. So the question is, what is wrong with rejoicing in this? Now, here's a man whose reign of terror has ended. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
A good thing.
That's a good thing. So we can rejoice in that, and that's good.
That's why I stated the discussion with, is this a paradox in the sense that we have an initial emotional response, and then we have an intellectual response that comes from...
Yeah, but I don't think the problem is that he went to hell, and that's what is tragic, because that's also a good thing. This is why I'm trying to parse it out a little bit.
Okay.
What is the tragic thing? The tragic thing is that someone made in the image of God has gone to ruin.
Exactly.
And that's really what, you know, when it says he'll be destroyed in the lake of fire, it means he's being ruined. He is not fulfilling his purpose that God made him for. He's suffering ruin and degradation. And so there's a loss of accomplishing that great goal that God envisioned for every human being in a certain sense when he made the human being. But it is not a good thing that such a bad person is being punished. Think of somebody else, you know, somebody who had a lot of good things going for them, and then they go south, and then they commit crimes, and they're punished for the crimes. Well, it's good that they're punished for what they did wrong. The thing that's sad is that they went south.
Right.
And I think it's at that point that we can object. But see, it's not. I mean, why object when he dies that he went south? He was already ruined.
Yep.
Before that, as we all are. So this could be an anguish about the human condition that we all have, but on balance, it's a good thing that happened. I mean, all those other things that he was going to hell and that he was ruined and all that was true before this. There's a net gain with his being absent from the earth, and I think that's a reason to be
Hey, Greg,
rejoicing.
One last thing, because I'm sure you have callers on board. For a long time, I've been wanting to ask you this. Have you read Victor Reppert's book, C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea?
I haven't. The Enforcer probably. Have you read it, Melinda? C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea. No, we haven't read it.
University Press. If you get the time, because I know if anybody's busy, you are, to check into it and see if someday you can get Victor Reppert on your program.
Did you catch that, Melinda? Yeah, we're writing it down. We'll check it out. So
okay.
Just in 30 seconds or 25 words or less, what was the dangerous idea?
The dangerous idea was that Darwin's idea, contrary to Daniel Dennett, was not as dangerous as the philosophers of mind and materialists and physicalists think.
Oh.
He gives arguments for mental causation, intentionality, truth, and in a very simplified way, he shows that Lewis, from his book Miracles, in his chapters 3 and 4, demonstrates that case for materialism if we take the life of the mind and rationality as truly existing.
Right. Okay, good. We'll give it some consideration, Pat. It's good to hear from you again. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Okay, all the best. Let's go to Dave. And before we do, just one last reminder, since it's the last 5 minutes of the last show before cruise signups come to an end, just a reminder, do not delay if you've been thinking about going on our cruise, because after this week, you will not be able to sign up. Last year, we had people that wanted to come and waited until too late. Now, they were able to get on by booking with another agency, and they got on the same ship that we were on, and they hung out with us, but they weren't cruising with us in the official sense, and we don't want you to have to go through that. This is the last time you can, this last week is the last you can sign up for our cruise, September 16th through 23rd. To New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. You don't want to miss this. This is going to be so much fun. Jay Richards is going to be with us. Kirby Anderson is going to be with us, and that's the talent that will be speaking to you along with myself. But the ports are going to be fantastic. We start out in Boston, then we go up to Maine and Bar Harbor, and then we go to Halifax and Sydney, and we go to where Anna Green Gables was at, and Charlottetown and Quebec City and Montreal. We finally disembark and fly back home. So please give that consideration, and if you are thinking about it, have been, now's the time to strike while the iron's hot, because it'll be dead cold in a week. Go to our website at str.org, and that's where you can sign up for our cruise. Okay, Dave in Atlanta. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi, how are you, Dave? I'm sorry, not Dave, Greg.
That's all right. You made it.
Yeah, just one thing before I ask my question. Just want to say I appreciate you so much, like you wouldn't believe it.
I first heard
you on CRI when you were the first time they had you on, introducing your tactics materials.
Uh-huh.
And I purchased it through CRI.
Good.
And when I heard of you, I got hooked. I went to your website and I downloaded every single MP3 I can get my hands on.
Well, I'm glad to hear that,
Dave. Listening to you.
Thanks a lot. Do you know that we have the tactics now in video and DVD, that the whole course in DVD? Did you know that?
Okay. I've heard you talk about it.
Okay, good.
And I plan to get that too. I plan to sign up for the ABC course first, though. And then
okay, good for you. Okay, we are a little tight in time, so you wanted to ask about tithing?
Yes. I read the article on the website about it, but I still have one question. It's in specific with 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I know it started in verse 1, but in particular verse 13 and 14, where Paul is kind of making a case that he and Barnabas has the right to wives and take support from the church.
Yeah.
And I'm using it for an argument to say it seemed like when they talk about tithing, in particular verse number 13, it says, "Do ye not know that they which minister about holy things live off the holy things of the temple?"
Right.
"And they which weigh the altar are partakers with the altar."
Right.
"This is so, has the Lord ordained." So I'm saying, Would that not be a powerful argument, since they seem to be appealing to the law or to the Old Testament?
Okay, good. Yeah, fair enough. Just to bring the rest of the group up to speed, the question is it does the New Testament teach that tithing is what we ought to be doing? The answer to – can we go another 2 minutes?
Yes.
Can we push over? I was talking to my crew here because we're so tight on time. The answer to that is categorically no. The New Testament does not teach tithing. Tithing was part of the law applying to Israel that does not apply to Gentiles. The New Testament has no teaching on tithing. The only time it's mentioned, Jesus mentions it in Matthew 23, and he's mentioning it in an Old Testament economy. He says you should tithe, but he also said that in the beginning of that passage, you should do everything that that those who teach the law of Moses tell you to do with regard to the law of Moses. So that's that economy. We are Gentiles. We are not under that law in that sense anymore. We are not obliged to tithe. That's why the New Testament never speaks of it. Now, in 1 Corinthians 9, it does talk about giving, and we have a responsibility to give and to help those that are in ministry. And Paul is arguing by analogy to the law in the verse that you mentioned. Do you not know, verse 13, that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar? Let me ask you a question, by the way. Uh-huh. Was that altar system, temple system, a bona fide, legitimate system that was operating at that time, according to Paul? Was it a legitimate system?
No, it wasn't
a legitimate system. So he is just simply, if it wasn't a legitimate system, and the book of Hebrews makes that pretty clear, then you can't take a piece out of that the system and say that that piece is still legitimate. That's not his point. His point is, in the old system, those people who worked in the nation of Israel at the altar benefited from the work because the people who they served helped them, and they did that through tithing.
Okay.
In the New Testament, we are New Testament ministers who are serving you in the same kind of way that those in the temple served the Jews and received a tithe, and therefore it is appropriate for us to receive gifts from you, not one-tenth of your income as part of the law, but gifts from you in support of us. The worker is worthy of his wages. And so he is drawing an analogy that just like in the Old Testament system, a worker is worthy of his wages, the minister, in the New Testament system, the worker is worthy of his wages too. He also says that you don't muzzle the ox while he's threshing. Now, the ox, when he's threshing, should get fed, okay? But, and so there is a parallel there. They were fed grain. The priests were given a tithe. Notice they're not the same, but there's a parallel in concept. And in the New Testament, there is support that's given to those who serve the Lord. And they have a justifiable expectation of getting paid for their efforts. That's the argument here. There is not a direct appeal to the law to tithe. If there was, Paul would have said it. This is the place where Paul would say, listen, this is not a new concept.
Yeah.
Moses said to tithe. Period. That's it. End of issue. He never says that because tithing didn't apply. Tithing was part of the old law that doesn't apply anymore. It is a new system, but there still is a need to support those who are working. It isn't by the legalistic 10%, but it is by giving, which may be 10, maybe 15, maybe 20. That's up to you, as each has determined in his own heart. Dave in Atlanta, thank you for the call. I'm glad that we're serving you well through Stand to Reason. And I will be back next week, friends, with more of the same. And it's been a joy to talk with you again after a little break here. Okay, this week, be good ambassadors for Christ, more like diplomacy than D-Day, and give them heaven, all right? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye, friends.